Now, again, this may seem really futuristic as of today, but so did, you know, self-driving cars and robotic dogs and all the other stuff as well, which is a reality now.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the FCAT Crypto Brief. I'm Matt Allen, and this week I'm joined by Jason Ward, Parth Gargava, and Max Waddington. Today, we're going to be covering everyone's favorite topic, the intersection of AI and blockchain, namely agentic payments. So we're going to cover a wide range of topics, including core infrastructure, solutions, some use cases, and risks. But I think just to get the conversation started, it's maybe helpful to define what an AI agent even is and why we're talking about this on a crypto podcast. So I think most people have probably at this point used an LLM, you know, such as ChatGPT, etc. And the way I would, you know, best describe what an AI agent is like using an LLM is kind of like having a car, right? It enables you the ability to drive somewhere. Having an AI agent is more analogous to having a self-driving car. You just tell the car, hey, I want to go from point A to point B, and it does everything for you. And so a pretty core piece of the infrastructure to enable agentic commerce, anything you would want your AI agent to do is going to be, how do you get your agent to pay for whether it be compute, software, services, etc. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. So Parth, I don't know, maybe it would be helpful just to start and set your views on like what we're talking about, what are agentic payments, like what's going on out there today?
Well, the way I think about this, Matt, is we are at this inflection point where we are seeing the agent as the customer, not the developer, not the human. And so what's really happening is this net new customer class needs its own payment credential and its own way to onboard. And what's interesting is we've used virtual cards in the past. I don't know how familiar you are with those single-use cards like X credit cards or privacy.com. There's actually something new which came out called Agent Card, which I tried using. And so what makes these virtual cards is the idea that you can essentially allocate a virtual card to an agent with some kind of controls. So make it single use, budget caps, make sure that it's only connected to one single merchant. And that's kind of the core idea of virtual cards. And that's exactly where we are in terms of agentic payments at scale today, where they have their own, they're still using credit cards, for instance. The question for us is that where do stablecoins fit in and how, you know, what is the benefit of programmability, which you can get as opposed to using a virtual card? And so I think, you know, the way my mental model for using stablecoins is if you have an agent that is using a data resource once in a while, then, you know, virtual card actually handles pretty fine. You don't need this whole setup in place. But imagine if you are running a task or a business which employs tens or hundreds of agents. In that scenario, when you do have a virtual card, the master agent has to make all the purchases for sub-agents and it gets fairly complex pretty quickly. And that's why it's important to have just native agentic payments for agents. Now, again, this may seem really futuristic as of today, but so did, you know, self-driving cars and robotic dogs and all the other stuff as well, which is a reality now. So that's how I think about agentic payments. I think about people think about the vibe coders of today and how they are the customers of tomorrow. I actually think that their agents, the agents of vibe coders, are the customers of tomorrow.
That's a great overview. And I think it's really interesting what you talked about there with like virtual cards. Like, would it be analogous to say that virtual cards are kind of like using gift cards to pay for everything and their limitations?
Yeah, exactly right. So if you go to any of these virtual card providers, essentially what you can do is you can sign up, get a new set of numbers every time you're interacting, every single time you're paying. And the next step of that is using agents. Now, I think when we talk about agentic payments too, I feel like it's such a broad category. It's evolving so quickly. So again, by the time this gets out there, maybe there's the seventh category of agentic payments. But I think the big piece here is one is agentic commerce. So you might have seen companies like OpenAI or Google come out with net new protocols on how you can do agentic commerce within ChatGPT or Gemini in this scenario. The second part where I think there's a lot of potential is just agent-to-agent payments. And this is where it gets really interesting, where how can you have valuable resources on the internet, which can be accessed by your agents? So, you know, two of the biggest friction points that we have seen right now is you run out of tokens. That's a pretty big problem, right? So you're using Cloud Code, you're using ChatGPT, and then you get a response saying, we'll come back after 7 hours because you ran out of tokens. So your agent hits that limit, and then you have to manually top up. So you connect your credit card, and then it starts working again. Or the second is you need an API key. So your agent needs a service, which means now Parth as the human has to go and connect, create an API key, which I provide to my agent, and that's how they can start interacting. But it's still a fairly clunky affair, and that's why I think that's why we're seeing this evolution on agentic payments.
Yeah, Parth, I loved how when you started describing this, you touched upon a couple of aspects that I think are going to be essential to the growth. And I think there's an opportunity for new standards to emerge. You talked about payment credentials. You know, we're literally in a space where today people log into a website, they want to access something, they've got to go through a CAPTCHA to prove they're not actually a bot. But we're going to have commerce and other types of interactions that are fully autonomous in the future if all the predictions come true. I'm curious, have you thought much about credentials for agents in, you know, sort of a, instead of a know your customer, know your agent type of dynamic?
Yeah, I think, Jason, a lot of these protocols that we hear about, they are essentially working on credentialing and authorization. So, you know, I think for anyone who might have heard about any sort of agentic payment protocol, like you might have heard of X402, AP2, ACP, and you know, you've glazed over it, you're not alone. There's a lot of people like you, and there is an alphabet soup, which I feel like a lot of people don't know what's going on with a lot of those protocols. But I think it's easy to say that, hey, there's these half a dozen net new protocols. I'm just going to wait it out until there's one protocol which emerges. And then, you know, this is still really futuristic. But what's important, and the nuance here is, when you start hearing about these new credentialing and authorization protocols, they're not all solving the same problem. So you have, you know, commercial protocols, which is where how agents buy stuff from merchants. Then there is simple B2B protocols, which is how do agents pay invoices. Then there is how do agents pay each other. And so I think you would think about this similar to how we have the internet, which has many protocols, but it's one experience, right? So like when you're doom scrolling, for instance, you're probably not thinking about TCP/IP or HTTPS or video protocols, for instance. You're probably, you know, not thinking about them at all. And that's the point. When these protocols all work together, the experience is fairly seamless. And the internet kind of missed out on this payment layer, which was the HTTP 402, and that's happening now.
It's a great description. And the reason I asked is we spent some time in the Blockchain Incubator looking into decentralized identity and verifiable credentials for how will people prove they are who they say they are when they want to conduct different types of transactions. And here, with this concept of agents conducting on someone's behalf, I've found myself questioning, will there be associations? You know, will people at some point need to essentially prove that an agent is their agent and only their agent? So I started looking into things like, you know, what are the types of structures that might be required? And I found some interesting commentary about people describing the current state as agent-ish, as, you know, on the way to fully autonomous. But I think it's interesting, this concept of, you talked about virtual cards. Have you heard of delegated sub-accounts where, you know, a user may have a wallet or a series of wallets and they'll delegate certain keys or certain sub-accounts to an agent to work on their behalf?
Absolutely. And Jason, I think that is the use case where virtual cards don't work, right? And that's where wallets become so much more important. So when you think about a virtual card and using that for paying your agent, the master agent has to make all purchases for all these sub agents. And so you're spending $5, you know, creating net new accounts. With wallets and with sub accounts, you can spin up as many sub wallets as needed, as often as required. And so I think the question here is, well, how do you verify the policies of this employee agent, right? And that also can be done on chain just because you have the ledger, which is publicly available. So I think the important part here is that it's not even about, here's where using wallets and stablecoins becomes even more interesting. It's not because stablecoins are cheaper. They're just better. It's a better 24/7 programmability use case. And that's exactly why I think when you start thinking about sub accounts, stablecoins become important.
I can't help but imagine being a human managing a bunch of different agents and having them compete as if you're the strategic investment committee determining how to allocate across these different agents. And then they have to pitch why their use is of higher relative value than the competitors. So we may not be that far away from that, actually, which is kind of crazy to think about.
It is coming, Jason. I think you're right. And I think maybe one signal which is worth talking about is Stripe and Tempo. So Tempo is the name of the blockchain. That is the blockchain which went on mainnet, I believe, a week ago. And so maybe Matt and Max, if you want to touch on Tempo, then we can further dissect it.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I'll give like a high level overview of like what I think is interesting about Tempo. And then we can dive into, I think, machine payments protocol. So Tempo was announced actually last year with backing by Stripe to be a stablecoin centric blockchain. And the idea is that it would be an extension of ERC-20 stablecoins. And it would essentially just be a blockchain that was stablecoin agnostic, and you could just use it to route any sort of stablecoin payment. And they've partnered with a lot of very high-level firms, including OpenAI and Anthropic, to actually implement this payments protocol. Now, I think that in and of itself is interesting because now we're talking about the stablecoin being the gas token. It removes a lot of frictions just from a payments perspective. But I would say the more interesting portion of the announcement was the machine payments protocol, which really is what we're talking about today, which is it enables agentic payments. So it has things like you can open a session where agents, as opposed to having to create transactions on chain for every single transaction that they go between each other, what they actually do is they open a session, which in my mind, you know, as a Bitcoin focused researcher, sounds a lot like a Lightning channel where, okay, like we're going to open this session for a month and we're going to complete this work and we're going to pay back and forth. And we're only going to settle on the blockchain one time, which I think is really interesting. So it's really a big step forward, I think, in agentic payments. Max, I'm curious, do you have any thoughts here?
Yeah, I mean, I spent a good amount of time looking at X402 because that's, you know, that protocol's been around for a little bit longer, incubated by Coinbase. And it's already had, I think this can be said for both MPP and X402, just the partnerships and like the products and APIs and services that are already available just a few months in, to me, is what's most surprising. Now, I'm pretty non-technical and I can look through the docs, and sometimes it's very clear when I'm like way over my head in terms of like how I would get this thing set up or how it's all constructed. But I'll be honest, X402 and some of these other protocols, they look relatively simple in terms of their construction. And I don't necessarily feel like I'm way over my head. You know, if I were to be, you know, someone to spin up an API that wants to provide some sort of service, it really feels like an accessible opportunity for both new businesses and then existing businesses that are just looking to, you know, offer their products and services in a different way. And my personally the favorite way is the pay per use. It's been something I've been asking just the gods for various like products and services that I don't necessarily want to subscribe to, but there might be like a really cool news article or story that I would love to read like once a year. And it's been really hard to get that. So that's kind of the clouds that are, I'm hoping will like clear as a result.
Max, that's a great point. And Matt, to the news that you covered, I agree with you that Tempo announcement is kind of the sideshow. The real story or the biggest story here is how Stripe came out with the machine payment protocol. So for those folks who are listening in, if you haven't checked it out, go to mpp.dev. That is that has a fun demo where you can actually check out how agentic payments work. So with, like, without setting up anything, it's meant to be a demo. But the core idea of the machine payment protocol is that you, to Jason's point, this is where you have full credentialing and authentication for autonomous machine-to-machine payments. So think about a use case where an agent hits a paid API endpoint, right? So if you go back to Max's example, if there's a Wall Street Journal article that he wants to read, but he doesn't wish to subscribe for the annual, for the news, then in that scenario, the agent hits a paid API endpoint, and they could get presented with a challenge, which is fulfilled when you pay, when you do some kind of crypto deposit using stablecoins, and automatically you receive a receipt, and that's it. Now that news article becomes unlocked for Max, and you don't have to go into subscriptions and you know, think about where you've spent a lot of money every month, because I've been in that process, and we were just talking about it before. So Matt, I think this sessions part is the most interesting piece, where it does look like Lightning, where you are, instead of settling each micropayment, you just open up this deposit box and then you settle periodically once in a while. So it is kind of almost an escrow pattern dressed up as OAuth for money. But it does solve that unit economics problem. But there are risks with it. And that's something which I would love to spend some time on where do you think there are big risks around agentic payments?
I think that's a great lead-in. You know, an interesting risk, and we talked about this earlier, is like, okay, like I give an AI agent, you know, access to a card, to my stablecoin account, and I'm super excited to go use Claude Code and build something, and maybe along the way I get a little bit off track and I'm using tokens that maybe aren't the most useful. And all of a sudden I look at my bill and it's like, oh, I just spent $1,000 in 2 days. how do we deal with that?
Totally. Jason, I was giving this example where I was caught in this exact situation, where I connected my Shopify to my Claude Code account, and I had auto reload on my Shopify, and my phone wasn't with me, and I was building this fun parking application. And then lo and behold, I look at my phone and I see, you know, $137 charged, and it kept reloading, and it wasn't even something that important. But then I realized that I've been spending money without any kind of ceiling, no cap, on the amount you could spend. And so, I couldn't ask for a refund either, but I think that is a big challenge. I've experienced that pain point now.
I just laugh because as a dad, I've had kids who've done online gaming, not realizing that they were racking up points. And now, with older kids who have access to cars and mobile apps, I cannot tell you what the ongoing, coffee bill is. So like nobody's allowed to auto reload, but it is an interesting situation. I think this is why in the current environment, you do have those limits. You have boundaries that people can set, because we just don't yet know what will be the pace of consumption. You may find that if you have a fully autonomous agent and they're very literal, you tell it to go do whatever it takes to get something done, they may expend a tremendous amount of resources looking to accomplish that goal. But I think it's really interesting because sometimes putting in a time boundary is a way to mitigate some of that risk. We were just joking a little bit earlier, like if I'm a human and I have a set of agents and I give them a task to accomplish, but they're competing with each other to have a higher relative value, it could go on and on and on as they continue to try and outcompete each other. So I think, you know, limiting values, maybe limiting time for things, maybe initial steps, but it goes a lot further. Even, you know, well, let's assume we solve for that. I sort of think about some of the news that hit the other day. I believe it's what happened in San Francisco with Waymo's a couple of months ago. Something happened, I believe, in China earlier this week, where some of the autonomous vehicles just stopped. And they weren't driving anywhere. Passengers couldn't open the doors. They're basically stuck inside an autonomous vehicle for some reason that's beyond their control. And I think clearly that's an extreme example of the types of things that can happen. But it is part of that progression that we're talking about. So you got to come up with thoughts around how do you protect against these extreme tail use cases.
I think there's a big compliance gap there, which is understandable because you're still in that innovation phase. But just the fact that agents can transact autonomously at scale will essentially force regulators to to figure out who bears liability when a bot overspends, or how do you do KYC, KYA of a wallet with no one behind it? And I feel like the policy questions are still genuinely unsettled, like they're not being discussed enough. But again, I think the low-hanging fruit for anyone building in this space is just having agentic wallet governance. Like, how do you make sure that there is some kind of governance so you don't, you know, go through what I and a lot of people have gone through, where you have programmable spending policies on top of machine payment protocols, where you can say, hey, if it goes beyond, like if I'm overspending more than $100 on Cloud Code, and if I'm not using it for this specific project, don't spend, right? Because it's not like one could be a fun project, one could be an actual project. So how do you build that governance model around a wallet for agents? That becomes really important.
And when they're machines, how do you provide structure for a machine to essentially execute self-care? As I say that, I think back. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but probably around 2016, AFCAT did some work with the Institute for the Future. And we had these scenarios. We come up with what would the future look like? And there are videos that are out there. One of the videos involved an autonomous vehicle named Mac. And Mac, in this little video, was picking up a couple of students from a place when they were going to a music lesson, and they were able to communicate with their parents. They were in the car. The car was taking them where they were going. And the thing that was funny is after that transaction was finished, Mac, the autonomous vehicle, decided to schedule himself an oil change. And he was already making the machine-to-machine payment that secured his spot in going and being maintained. So it's kind of crazy that 10 years later, we're talking about this as a reality, but now talking about essentially coding and building out businesses and affecting financial transactions. So it's eerily accurate as to how those predictions were made about 10 years ago.
And I think there was also this sense that for some reason, we thought that at some point, internet payment will get solved for. Like you didn't have, Max, I believe it was in 1997 when HTTP 402 was first used for, and it said payment required, but it just was never implemented until Coinbase took it up. So the internet was designed to move information, and I feel like commerce just got added on top of it. And then we started using credit cards, but essentially, even in terms of payments, we don't really do actual payments. We do financial messaging systems. If you think about Swift, you're just sending a message to someone else, but the actual payment is still happening by the banks, which is internationally takes 30 days, domestically takes 1 or 2 days. So I think this is the actual first internet payment rail. That's how I think about it. Like I feel like the agents expose this gap just because they're a net new actor. And that's why you need to get the plumbing in place.
I think that's a great point, Parth, because it's not often talked about that there was an error code built into the internet for payments. And there was always kind of this idea that payments on the internet were coming, and then we just built messaging systems on top to solve the problem and kind of ignore the original like thought process and potential solution. And now, what is it, like 28 years later, we're seeing an implementation to solve for 402. I think that's just a great kind of anecdote. But I want to go back to something that you said, Parth, and that I find really interesting, which is as we're talking about like setting rails and, you know, programmability for agentic payments, I think it's an interesting topic to talk about where stablecoins fit into this aspect as opposed to other traditional payment methods and the programmability of stablecoins and maybe the opportunities there for blockchain to really solve some of these problems as opposed to traditional payment methods. Because I think you can just add on that level of programmability into your stablecoins that isn't necessarily available from a credit card. But I'm curious your thoughts on that.
I think I agree. The whole power of stablecoins was programmability and just having customized rules at scale. So I think, you know, we did quickly talk about how, to Jason's point, how you can have sub-accounts, which is effectively our sub-wallets. That's how I think about them. You have one master. It's kind of like how you have one XPub key, but then you have child addresses. In a similar vein, you have one master agent, which has one master wallet, and you can have sub-accounts. But I think virtual cards are fantastic if you're not transacting at scale and if you're doing it one-off. But I think the programmability part is what's the most important part for stablecoins. And I do feel like we're on our path to get software that can discover, negotiate, pay for resources autonomously. And I think at this point of time, there's like 7-8 net new protocols, but it is coming regardless of whichever protocol wins.
Yeah. And as you guys talked about the X402 Foundation, obviously it's initiated by Coinbase. It's hosted by the Linux Foundation. And when I was doing some research into this, I found out that there's some major hyperscalers that are now part of this effort. You've got Amazon Web Services, you've got Microsoft, Google, Stripe, Visa, MasterCard, and others are all contributing to the development of this capability. And I think that's really interesting because part of this, you talked about stablecoins being the right utility. You've got really small micropayments that can be made on chain at a lower cost that wouldn't really be efficient or frankly, maybe not that desirable for some of the major traditional payment rails, just because the cost of processing the transaction probably exceeds the value of the transaction itself. So I think it's really interesting. And I think your comments about, you know, instead of solving for value transfer, we solve for messaging of transactions. It's spot on. I mean, the ISO formatted messages that transfer across the SWIFT network and other direct channels, they're all instructions. They're not the actual settlement. Here you have the opportunity to affect settlement in near real time, if not real time.
Jason, can I ask for a hot take from you? If now you don't really need receipts and messages to go from one place to another, then what is the point of that financial messaging system if you can actually now move assets from one place to another? So how do you think about networks like SWIFT?
It's a very interesting question. What I would say is networks like SWIFT are so deeply embedded into the global financial system that they are likely to adopt this type of technology as opposed to be eliminated by it. And I think it's going to take a long time for that to happen. Frankly, it's an interesting question. I've asked folks from SWIFT a number of times over the years, and what I can say is, you know, back in 2017, 2018, they thought they had a very long time, decades. Now they're talking about trying to integrate with different distributed ledger technologies to help them with that. But what you're really talking about, and a classic example here, not SWIFT, but the largest securities depository, DTCC, is talking about tokenization of assets. They're still talking about settling delivery versus payment in traditional form, and then turning around and creating a token after the fact. And then when somebody wants to sell it, they'll actually have to convert it, burn the token, and go back to regular way settlement. And then the other party that wants token can do that. So like, they're replacing, in some cases, the process with new technology as opposed to rethinking the entire process for outcomes. So I give it as an example because it's some recent publications that they've had. They're moving to try to get to 24/5 settlement trading for stocks and bonds. A lot of that today is driven by the ISO formatted messages that go over the SWIFT network. You've got duration between trade and settlements. You've trade, then it goes to clearing, and from clearing to settlement. You can really condense that and reduce the capital that's required. But getting to the point of, is that messaging system still required? I think instructions are required. And I think instructions and verification that the instructions have been acted upon and the transaction achieves settlement finality are the requirements. How they achieve that by adopting this technology will take some time to play out. But, you know, if you wanted to be very controversial, you could say you could just use a different rail to affect the same instruction settlement at a faster pace. Big challenge getting all those market participants to then transfer their existing flows onto this new technology. So that adoption curve would really be a driver in A, whether or not that is feasible, and B, when that could be achievable.
Yeah, that's a great way to end it, because I think it's interesting to see so many net new businesses not thinking about really specific problems. So we covered Tempo, which is only focused on inexpensive, fast transactions. And I think maybe there's a whole market opportunity to do exactly what you described.
Yeah, and I think folks are working on stepping stones. Like, these are not their desired outcomes. They're trying to figure out how can they start that progression. So it's going to be exciting to see.
It certainly is. But I think that is, as Parth mentioned, a great way to end it. Max, Parth, Jason, thank you so much for joining. And thank you to everyone who listened in. We'll be back in 2 weeks. We're talking about quantum computing. So another fun, exciting topic. But thanks, everyone, and have a great week.
Hey, crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2026 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.